Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just 10 bucks. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. Friends, I gotta say, this has been one hell of a week for me. Nothing deadly, nothing that warrants conversation. Just one of those weeks where everything seems to conspire against you and bog you down with every step you take. Along those lines, we're going to breeze through this intro here and get into the meat. Tonight's docket has two stories for you. The first, Another Round for Ouroboros by Ambrose Ibsen, chronicles the endeavors of a young occultist seeking the last bit of arcane knowledge that he needs, a journey that has taken him longer than he might realize. After that, we'll be reading The Hallway Game by Craig Groeschek, which shows that even for a young orphan in a new and strange group home, things can always get weirder and worse. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Ambrose Ibsen, I give you Another Round for Ouroboros. I burrowed into my jacket to keep off the rain and went hurtling, head low, along the empty sidewalk toward the library. 8 floors of glass and concrete glowered down upon me and at every squat building in its tremendous footprint. Nothing else on the entire campus rivaled it in size. And from a distance, one couldn't help imagining that the university's entire plan had been sketched in such a way as to pay the towering library homage. The grounds had sat empty for a week, perhaps two, since classes had let out for spring break, and the usual bustle of students had retreated to the warmer corners of the planet. But I was not a student. Although I walked the same paths between the buildings as the students did, crouched beneath the same awnings and referenced the same rain-streaked signs, I had not paid for the privilege to do so. I was a visitor, a trespasser. Chiefly, I was an imposter. I clutched at the student ID in my pocket, the one I'd paid a desperate grad student a tidy sum for, and rushed through a sodden courtyard for the library's yawning entrance. The doors slid open and admitted me to a dimly lit vestibule done up in gray carpet. There, stationed by the glass inner door, a bored-looking campus security guard nodded off over a magazine and met me with a start. I had practiced for this interaction, had been preparing all night for it, and so, when he fixed me with a curious look and asked, "Can I help you?" I knew to react with authentic coolness. Brushing the rain from my hair, I shook my head. "Can you believe this weather? I bet it's a lot nicer over in Ibiza right now, am I right?" From my pocket, I drew out the little orange card and held it between my fingers. "Wish I knew what it was like to go on break. Instead, I'm still catching up." The low-paid guard, lulled into conspiratorial fraternity by my chatter, took merely a glance at the orange card before he bought my story wholesale. I studied his eyes closely and knew within the space of an instant that I'd succeeded. The possibility of my being a counterfeit never crossed his mind. Chuckling, he sat upright on his stool and nodded. "I hear ya. I was gonna take a little trip down to Florida with my friends, but I just couldn't afford it this year." His hand moved toward a little number pad on the wall, and punching in a few buttons, he prepared to admit me. "What's your major?" he asked. "Pre-med," came the pre-rehearsed lie. "If I don't grind during this break, I'm gonna flunk the finals. I can feel it." "Gotcha." The door slid open, and the vestibule was filled with the dry, stuffy air of the interior. The smells of dust and old paper sent a thrill coursing through me. "Well, good luck to you. We're closing up at 8 tonight, and there are only a few librarians available right now. Let them know if you need anything." "Thanks, man," I replied, striding past him. "Take it easy." Like that, I was in. I started across the tiled floors, my jacket leaving a trail of cold drops in my wake, and entered into an almost smothering silence. Smothering because I wanted nothing more than to celebrate my successful fraud with a cry of joy. I was so close now to reaching my objective, to securing my prize, that my hands trembled with excitement. I had not come in search of medical textbooks or anything at all like what the idiot guard by the entrance might have assumed. Instead, my target was something far more obscure, something that ordinary students likely did not have access to. There was one particular book, or more specifically, a segment contained within one particular book, that I was after, and in order to secure it, I would have perpetrated any fraud, would have gone to any lengths. You see, months of feverish research had led me to this very university, which was a drive of several hours from my home in a neighboring state. Only here, I had discovered through the weaving together of many disparate threads, were the unpublished works of a particular author available, works of which I had a gnawing, insatiable need. But it does the great man an injustice to refer to him simply as an author. He was no mere spinner of yarns, no fantasist. No, he was a scholar, a visionary, a giant whose revelations earned him at once the revulsion and awe of his peers, and whose sum of published work provides, to this day, the single most thorough exploration of what is commonly referred to as the occult. I have been, for most of my adult life, an admirer and acolyte of this man, a humble walker of the same psychical footpaths, and have read and reread virtually every word of his that was printed within his lifetime. Every word, that is, except for those which are housed within the tomes and letters he bequeathed to this university, his alma mater. This private collection, unknown to all but the most dedicated followers of the Shroud, has been rumored to contain a great and many things which, if applied by an able mind, would serve to plug the minute gaps within the most powerful occult systems known to man. You will understand now what brought me to this distant library on a cold and rainy afternoon, why I took such pains to concoct this fraud and intrusion. Somewhere within the walls of this towering edifice was the final ingredient. The key I needed to unlock transcendence. Upon sighting one of the rare librarians, I had only to deploy a plastic smile to go about my way, cheerfully dismissing their offers for help and finding what I sought. though the library could likely hold many dozens of studying students, and perhaps many more when the upper floors were taken into account. I spied only two or three in my entire traversal of the ground level. My progress to the stairwell and subsequent hike to the fourth floor suffered no interruption. Unwilling to leave anything to chance, I had done a thorough study of the library prior to visiting, and knew that the papers of my idol were housed on the fourth level, in a little temperature-controlled hovel dubbed the Allerby Room, where the works of famous alumni were committed. It was to the door of this precise room that I skulked with the ill-gotten ID card close at hand, and I found it with little trouble, for it was situated a mere 10 or 15 yards from the stairwell, down a long corridor whose stuffiness was profound. The door to the Allerby Room was unsurprisingly locked, accessible only through the use of a wall-mounted card reader. For this reason, I had sought the ID card of a graduate student enrolled in the university's library sciences program. Students of that stripe were often employed by the library itself, and thus enjoyed the easiest access to the institution's more restricted collections. No matter the care I'd taken in my planning, I held my breath and trembled upon swiping the card through the reader, half wondering if my attempt would take. I was prepared to do whatever was necessary to enter the little room. I was not above brute forcing the card reader or even smashing through the glass door. None of that proved necessary, however. My forceful swipe of the card produced, after a few beats of fraught silence, a thrilling click. I pulled open the door and slipped into the Allerby Room with a laugh I could not contain, and at once canvassed the ceiling for security cameras. I walked from corner to corner, finding none, and wagered that the space was thus unmonitored. I left the lights off, negotiating the tall stacks solely by the weak light seeping in from the north-facing windows. Each of the 30 or 40 shelving units packed into the room were taller and wider than I and laden with books, boxes, and binders. These materials were arranged by author, which made zeroing in on my quarry a thing of ease. Not 2 minutes after slipping into the room, I located the works of my beloved mentor. 3, 4 minutes beyond this, spent in a mixture of ecstasy and reverent contemplation, I struck upon the item which had drawn me across state lines. I held in my hands the unpublished draft of my idol's final work, a dense treatise on the occult which had taken the better part of a decade to write. Fragments of this masterpiece had seen limited release prior to his untimely passing, but the astounding whole had never made it to the printers, and what little had been loosed upon the world posthumously had been neutered by his executors. Whether this had been a work of maliciousness or ineptitude, I could not say. The leather-bound book, heavy and smooth, was exactly as my mentor had left it, and I ran my fingers against the soft cover, secure in the knowledge that the great man's fingers had once explored these same creases. We were, through this medium, connected across space and time. I dove into the volume at once, sitting upon the floor with my back pressed to one of the burgeoning shelves. Within, I discovered hundreds of pages, both handwritten and typed. And one thing else. Unexpectedly, I discovered a small bit of cardstock pasted into the inside cover, the stamped header of which declared the tome the property of the university's private collections. Beneath this was a series of stenciled lines, where borrowers of the piece, in a time before computers, would have written their names prior to checking it out. It was not the presence of this little artifact that surprised me. No, rather, as I glanced over the card and prepared to turn the page, I found, upon the provided lines, a single name. It was this name which gave me pause, and which drew an incredulous little laugh from lips which had, only moments ago, been pursed in studious excitement. I was looking at my own name, written in my very own hand. Blinking at the strip of cardstock, I ran my finger across the entry. It was blue ballpoint, and the penmanship was clearly and bewilderingly mine. My full legal name was transcribed there, though I had no affiliation whatsoever with the university and had never been, till that very afternoon, within 100 miles of the Allerby Room. Moreover, I knew that I had never seen the book before. It had been my greatest dream to read this volume and apply its esoteric teachings. Had I so much as touched its cover in passing, I would have recorded the memory as among the most joyous days of my life. I was certain that I had never seen the book and had never had occasion to borrow it before. All the same, there was my name. Ignoring the fact that it was clearly my handwriting on the slip, I wondered if, perhaps, my late mentor had another admirer who shared my name. I dismissed this possibility out of hand. My name is not a common one. In fact, on account of my parentage, it is considered not a little strange and exotic. I believe it to be rather unique, and doubt that another person on the planet has ever shared my exact name. But how, then, had it wound up here?
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I don't know how long I sat there, mystified. I plugged deep into memory, but could not recall ever having encountered any of the materials within the Ellerby room, much less this diamond I had pined after for so long. Reaching dead end after mental dead end, I realized that I had no choice but to wash my hands of the uncanny thing, to return to my planned purpose. Certain that I held in my hands the object of my years-long search, I tucked it into the inner pocket of my messenger bag and immediately planned to flee the premises. Bag tightly fastened, jacket on, I passed between the shelves and made a beeline for the door. My exit from the room was simple enough, and a profound relief washed over me as I heard the door click shut to my back. Arriving once again in the long hallway outside, however, I was burdened by a subtle but sudden shift in atmosphere, a vague feeling which I've always attributed to being watched. I stood at the hall's end with my bag clutched to my person and tossed a wary gaze down the corridor's length, where it briefly flirted with the departing heels of another library-goer. The individual, moving too quickly in the dim passage for me to get a very solid look at them, gave me quite a fright. But when I had had a moment to gather myself and realized it had been nothing but a harmless librarian or wandering student, I proceeded to find the stairwell and began a quick descent. Here, too, I felt chased by foreign eyes, despite the conspicuous lack of others above or below me. Each landing was clear, and I encountered no one in my downward progress. Stepping out onto the ground level, I found I attracted the gaze of every librarian I crossed. Though none said a thing to me, and their bland attentions did not suggest the least knowledge of my theft. I left them behind with a casual wave. The guard at the door was disarmed once again by tactical pleasantries, and within 5 minutes of having stuffed the book into my bag, I was out in the rain again, struggling to contain my excitement. The library, I'm quite sure, watched me as I fled back across the sodden courtyard and skipped through the mist with a Cheshire grin. The titanic structure seemed to lean in inspection of me, its lengthy shadows reaching out like a grasping hand in an effort to reclaim what belonged to it. I was soon out of range, fumbling around in my pockets for my keys. A few lots over, my compact rental sat curbside. I didn't bother to engage the wipers to put on my seatbelt. I concentrated everything I had towards speeding to the hotel room I'd booked in the next town over. There, I planned to put my new acquisition to use. The bed and nightstand were pushed against the door, and the window was carefully blocked with large pieces of cardboard I'd brought along for the purpose. The ceiling vent was similarly covered, and the bathroom door tightly shut, so as to keep dwellers in nearby rooms from hearing what I was getting up to. I bunched up the rug on the floor and threw it aside, choosing for my canvas the faux wooden floor beneath. Having posed as a traveler, the hotel staff hadn't batted an eye at the large bags I'd hauled in with me from the rental car, and from these I withdrew the tools of my trade. Vials of thick white paint and a pair of brushes, one thick, the other thin, were set out on the floor. Six unburnt candles had been packed along, the first five of which were to be used in the ritual. The other was to be utilized as my sole source of personal light in traversing the room, for the work which I was soon to begin had been pioneered in an age far before the invention of artificial lighting. Sunlight had to be assiduously forced out of the room, for the forces I planned to consort with were no friends of the day. The thick brush was used to paint a vast circle, and certain of the larger pictographic flourishes which the work necessitated, while the thinner brush allowed me to fill in finer details with a more exacting accuracy. Characters older than the pyramids were set down upon the floor of that room, with such painstaking care that sweat dripped in rivulets from my nose. Merely viewing the language of the ancients was enough to make me shudder, enough to make me wonder if the shadows stirring in the corners were merely a trick of the candlelight, or astral travelers come to participate in the ritual. Hours passed while I took care of numberless other preparations. The room in which I dwelt had been paid up for several days, and the staff had been instructed not to disturb me under any circumstances. The other preparations for the task ahead had all been internal. I speak, of course, of the three-day fast I had undertaken in anticipation of the ritual. Empty as a drum, I finally took a seat upon the floor and cleared my mind, my idol's magnum opus situated before me. There, by candlelight, I dove headfirst into the stolen tome, at first with great care and a measure of misty-eyed sentimentality, then in pursuit of the choice segment relevant to my work, with seeming fever. Page by page, the blanks in my knowledge of the cosmos, however few, were astonishingly filled, and with this new knowledge I felt my spirit writhe within me as a butterfly does in its chrysalis. The newly opened eye yearned for sight. I knew myself standing on the frontier of a new existence, of a state of being far beyond what we call consciousness. In my furious turning of the pages, I came away toward the end with a deep cut across my thumb, and I remember I laughed. "No, no, it's not yet time for blood," I told myself, nursing the wound as I finished reading. Spiritually engorged with a new awareness, I had only to follow the simple directions now, the directions to the ritual I myself had pioneered based on the writings of my beloved mentor. My years of work and study had culminated in this final collaboration with my idol, and now I was set to complete the grand experiment of transcendence that had eluded him. The clock on the wall told me it was still early in the evening. I would have to wait until the hour hand ticked beyond the 12 to begin, for in those shadowed hours the gulf between worlds is at its narrowest. I sat upon the floor in the ornate ring of my own creation, with no food or drink passing my lips, and only ecstatic meditations visiting my mind. And at a minute past midnight, I took the dagger from my bag and dragged its razor-sharp tip across my palm. By several squeezes, I distributed my pure essence across the circle and spoke the words that had first come to man in the language of dreams. The gore that seeped from my rent palm looked black in the low light, like so much India ink smeared across the floor. The requisite gestures and incantations were performed, body and mind sparking with the energy of the infinite. And when all was said and done, when the recipe had been followed to the letter, only one barrier remained before proper consummation could take place. Fingers sticky with dried blood, I reached out and snuffed the wicks of all six candles, burying the room in perfect darkness. There, crouched on the floor like an animal, I awaited the coming of the one who would bear the ultimate truth. Darkness and time collided against one another ad infinitum. The blows were so great and constant that concepts such as minutes and hours broke down. I can't say how long I was plunged into that chaotic world, that space between, but when the first stirrings of arrival took place, my ears were there to hear them. I heard, at first, what sounded like a slight rustling. Yes, a sound like the pages of a book being hurriedly turned. This gave way to harsher, crumpling sounds, a tensing and ripping. And then, a deep, guttural groaning, The space was packed with the noises of one who had transcended the need for breath, and so it poured out of him in one note, continuous and intoxicating. The frequency wound its way into my ears, where it poured into my skull like warm water and massaged both sides of my brain with strong fingers. I was so caught up in the thrill of success that I couldn't help lighting my candle to watch, with worldly eyes, the spectacle then unfolding. The candle was put on by a single spark, and when the flame had stabilized, I thrust it forth into the darkness which had grown and hardened around me like a scab. My mentor's book sat splayed upon the floor before me, shedding a profusion of pages like a chicken losing feathers. Gradually, its binding became visible, a convulsing tangle of black and red thread. The leather cover twitched against the floor as the book's spine hitched and cracked. The inner seam was splitting, and more pages were being jettisoned, leaving a dark, widening gap where they had once been rooted. It was from this pulsing gouge that the groaning visitor came. Inching upward like a column of toothpaste from a flattened tube, a gangly human body emerged from the book's central seam. Unclothed, the figure's skin was white as snow, but was everywhere ringed with thin red wounds, like long paper cuts. As the figure lurched and wriggled, its body would list to one side or the other side, and the wounds would momentarily flare open to reveal the pink, goreless interior of its body. The effect resembled something between the winking of a million gills and the spiral cut of a holiday ham, its slices jostled by an impatient cook. Its head was low, and it wore upon its face a single page of the book, a clean, blank sheet. I knelt before the thing in awe, its groaning so relentless that it became almost painful to listen to. "Welcome," I gasped, bowing to the floor. "Welcome." Suddenly, the thing ceased its groaning. I looked up at it, oddly frightened by the silence.
You've come from the realm beyond and carry with you the knowledge of eons. You carry within you the knowledge necessary to help me transcend my feeble existence. Show me, please. Let the honey drip from your tongue and into my ears, Master."
But the visitor did not comply. Instead, it pointed down toward the leather-bound womb from which it had sprung.
"You still don't understand, do you?"
issued a faint, withered voice from behind the thing's papery mask. I jerked to attention.
"What do you mean? Please, instruct your servant."
The thing drew a lily-white hand towards its face and tugged away the veil of paper, revealing itself in full. And I couldn't help screaming at the sight of it. Once again, the figure pointed down at the book, thoroughly ruined. The inside cover was visible, the one the strip of cardstock had been glued to, the cardstock where my name had appeared.
"You still don't understand. You've been here before."
I was staring up at nothing less than my own face. It had been ravaged by the same cuts as the rest of the body, so that the eyes and tongue slipped and bulged between slices of spiralized flesh.
"It was a success,"
uttered my doppelganger. The parted layers of his face clapped and shuddered as he laughed.
"You did everything by the book. You wanted to leave behind your humanity, and you did so. This is what awaits you."
"Wait, I stammered. "I don't understand."
"But you do understand,"
I replied.
"And you got what you wanted. You've been woven into the infinite, stitched in. The knowledge, all of it, is yours, and it always will be. You are one with it."
I dropped the candle. It struck the floor, guttering madly for an instant. When the light stabilized, I realized that the figure was no longer there, that I was alone in the room, slumped in the circle with only the ruined book for company. Without warning, the silence was pierced by a fresh bout of that resonant groaning. This time, however, I recognized it to be coming from my throat. Despite the stillness and lack of wind, the loose pages of the book began to flutter and flap, and the leathern shell curled and stretched. I felt my hair being tugged, my body being dragged toward the damaged tome. The frayed binding snagged my hair and began incorporating it, strand by strand, as I was fed gradually into the yawning seam. The strength went from my limbs as the remaining pages cut into me. The damaged spine of the book was hardened by my own spine, and the leather cover became all the more supple for the incorporation of my own flesh. The book was in me. I was in the book. My idol's writings had transcended mere theory, and I had transcended my humanity. Both were locked now in a demonic marriage of perpetual consumption. The greater my desire for forbidden truths, the greater its hunger for me. I had borrowed the book once. I remembered it now. A long time ago, I had borrowed the text and attempted what my mentor had not dared attempt in his lifetime. All existence since that moment had been spent in a tug of war with the fabric of reality. It was not the human body I wished to overcome any longer. No, I would have welcomed my old body with open arms now. My every thought, my every desire, was to somehow break free of the book, to reverse what I'd done. Somewhere in the book, I was quite sure, I'd find the knowledge necessary to do so. I was swallowed, digested, thrust down into a darkness without equal. And there, I schemed against the thing that used my hair for its stitching and my skin for its cover. I secretly rebelled against the object I had once coveted and plotted my escape, my transcendence. Ah, finally, the light of day, cool air, the scent of grass, rain upon my skin. Yes, an opportunity. It's been so long, but I know the knowledge is just around the corner. I'm so close to the solution I've been looking for. I start across the courtyard and set my sights on the towering library. There is a book in its special collections which contains the answer. I'm certain of it. I've never read it before, but my late mentor worked on it for years before his death. If anywhere one can find the knowledge to transcend, to break free, then it will be between those pages. I have fooled my way inside, climbed to the fourth floor. The air is stuffy and the lights are dim. Here, then, lies the greatest work of my mentor, sure to contain the wisdom I seek. Finding the tome is the work of some few moments, but when I crack the cover, I discover something unexpected. My name is written on the checkout slip. How odd, I think to myself. I've never borrowed this book before. Strange though it is, there's no time to waste. I stuff the book into my bag and rush out of the building with a mind towards carrying out the ritual. Finally, I found it. The key to transcendence is somewhere within these pages.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for. With SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just 10 bucks. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You've been listening to Another Round for Ouroboros by Ambrose Ibsen. Once upon a time, a young Ambrose Ibsen discovered a collection of ghost stories on his father's bookshelf. He was never the same again. Apart from horror fiction, he enjoys good coffee, brewed strong. Connect with him on his official website, ambroseibsen.com. Next, to close out tonight's episode, I present The Hallway Game by Craig Groeschek. Eli Carver was the quiet one, and everyone knew it. Even the younger kids, who shrieked over cartoons and scraped their sneakers across the kitchen tile as if it were a game, gave him space. Perhaps it was the way he held that worn Polaroid, as if it might crumble if they looked at it too closely. Maybe it was how he typically nodded instead of answering questions when he could. The photo had faded at the corners, with yellow creeping in as if it had caught some kind of sickness. But her smile remained, soft and slightly tilted to one side, a little crooked, as if she hadn't been ready when the picture was taken. His mother. Eli kept it under his pillow at night and in his hoodie pocket during the day. It was one of only a handful of personal items he brought with him after the fire trucks arrived, and his most prized possession. The house he'd been placed in lacked the feeling of a home. It smelled of bleach and boiled rice, and everything was carpeted, even the bathrooms, as if the owners had hoped it'd muffle the noise. Miss Julia did her best. She cooked, hugged when asked, and didn't yell. However, there were too many kids and not enough hours in the day. She moved through the rooms like a ghost in house slippers, one hand always holding either folded laundry or someone's medications. She appeared tired in every photo on the fridge. There were rules, like in any other place. No outside calls, no food in your room, lights out by 9, and no going into the hallway after bedtime. That last rule wasn't official. It was more of a warning passed between bunks in hushed voices, the way kids shared secrets they weren't supposed to know. Eli had heard it during his first week there, tucked between the sounds of a sneeze and a cough under someone's blanket. "They say if you stand in the middle of the hallway with a candle and knock 3 times, you can bring someone back," a voice whispered. Eli hadn't meant to listen, but the beds were close together and the floor creaked whenever anyone turned over. He stayed still and quiet, his heart skipping a little at the mention of bringing someone back. "Trevor did it once," someone else chimed in. "Before you arrived. He doesn't talk anymore, but he used to. He saw something. He tried to bring his brother back. No, it was his mom." "That's not what I heard." A loud shush silenced them, followed by a muffled laugh. This was the first time Eli truly noticed Trevor, the older boy kept to himself. He was lanky and pale, with a thick mop of black hair and a sluggish way of moving, as if his limbs weren't entirely connected. He sat near the window during quiet time, filling notebooks with dark ink drawings of narrow halls, stretched faces, and shadowy doorways that led nowhere. Miss Julia called him creative, while the other kids referred to him as creepy. Eli had seen the drawings and didn't think they were bad, just depressing, like someone recalling dreams that didn't belong to them. That night, he struggled to sleep as he lay in his bed. The hallway outside his room was dark, save for the dim safety light above the smoke alarm. The carpet out there always seemed damp, even when it wasn't. Eli watched it from his doorway, the pale rectangle of light stretching down toward the kitchen like a tongue. He didn't know why it scared him so much. After all, it was just a hallway. But the thought of stepping into it after lights out made something curl in his stomach, as if it wanted to hide. So he stepped back and shut the door softly. The next morning at breakfast, Eli sat across from Trevor at the long table. Trevor was drawing again, pressing hard into the paper with a stubby pencil. Eli caught glimpses of what he was working on. Hands, far too many of them, reaching out from behind a woman's back. Her face wasn't quite complete, but her teeth were. Dozens of them, all too small and even, stretched into a smile that seemed to extend beyond the edges of her jaw. Trevor noticed Eli looking and yanked the notebook shut. Their eyes met for a brief moment. Eli flinched. Trevor did not. Later, in the common room, Eli sat on the floor and flipped the Polaroid between his fingers, careful not to smudge it. The photo had a burn mark near the bottom corner, just a kiss of black, as if the fire had nearly taken it, too. He reflected on what the boys had said about the candle, the knock, and the hallway. The idea unsettled him, and yet he had to admit he was intrigued. That night, long after Miss Julia finished her last chore, turned off the hallway light, and retired to her bedroom, Eli sat up in bed and listened. The house made its usual sounds, pipes ticking, a screen door rattling faintly against the wind. But beneath that, he sensed something else, the soft drag of fingers on the carpet. He didn't open the door, too frightened to confirm his suspicions. Instead, he got up, took the candle from the drawer near the art supplies, and hid it under his bed, just in case. Trevor's notebook was missing the next morning. Eli had waited until everyone else had gone out to the playground, pretending to dig through the art drawer for more glue sticks. He remained in place until Miss Julia went outside with the group. However, when he opened the drawer under Trevor's bunk, he found it was gone. Eli was certain Trevor had seen him. He hadn't said a word, but he just watched from across the room as Eli walked away with his hands empty. The rest of the day dragged on. To keep himself busy, Eli helped fold towels in the laundry room, but his thoughts kept drifting back to Trevor's drawings, particularly the woman's smile, and about what the other kids had said about the hallway ritual. That night, while the others brushed their teeth, Eli walked past the bathroom and headed down the hall toward the far end, where the bedrooms met the storage room. The carpet muffled his steps, and he stopped near the center of the hallway, where a square of moonlight spilled onto the floor from the cracked curtain above. He looked down and ran his foot along the seam in the carpet. This had to be the place. "Don't." The voice came from behind him, barely audible. Eli turned around to find Trevor standing near the bathroom door, with his arms crossed and eyes cast down. He didn't move or come closer. He just stood there, waiting for Eli to say something. Eli swallowed and stepped toward him. "I just want to see her," he said. Trevor didn't respond. After a few seconds, he reached into the front pocket of his hoodie and pulled out a folded scrap of notebook paper. Without meeting Eli's eyes, he held it out. Eli hesitated for a moment before taking it. Trevor turned and walked away. The paper had one word written on it in shaky block letters: rules. On the other side, there was more, written hastily as if the pen had fought against the paper. Rules for the hallway game. 1. Must be after lights out. 2. Must be alone. 3. Light a candle and place it in the center of the hallway. 4. Knock on the floor 3 times. 5. Say their name clearly. 6. Leave something they loved beside the candle. 7. Walk away without looking back. Eli read it repeatedly that night, long after the others had gone to bed. The note felt crumpled and soft at the edges, like it had been folded and unfolded too many times. Although the rules didn't seem complicated, something about the way they were written felt like a warning, a dare that had been regretted. Still, the idea worked its way into his thoughts. What would he tell everyone if it worked? What would she say? He opened the drawer by his bed and pulled out an old candle he had taken earlier. It was a fat red one with a stub of wick and waxy fingerprints near the base. He didn't have matches, but he remembered that the kitchen had a lighter tucked near the stove, one Miss Julia used for birthday candles. His mother's antique locket was still tucked in the lining of his backpack. It was broken and no longer clasped shut, but it still contained that tiny photo of her and his late grandmother on the beach, their hair tied back, as they laughed at something off camera. One of her favorite things. He'd held onto it all this time, hoping to salvage the memories. He sat with it in his hand for a long time before tucking it under his pillow. That night, Eli waited until the usual evening sounds had ceased, Miss Julia's footsteps creaking overhead, someone coughing in the next room, the click of the back door latch, and silence enveloped the home. He pulled on his sweatshirt, slipped the locket into his pocket, and padded quietly into the hallway, which seemed longer than it should have been, its edges disappearing into the shadows stretching strangely along the walls. Moonlight slanted through the curtains, but it felt faded somehow, too pale to be of any use. Eli crouched at the midpoint and set the candle on the floor. He lit it with the plastic lighter he had taken earlier. The flame flickered, but held steady. He placed the locket beside it, and his fingers trembled as he withdrew his hand. Without thinking, he acted, knocking once, twice, three times. "Danielle Carver," he whispered. The flame shook once, but didn't go out. He waited, his heart racing with anticipation. Nothing had changed. There was no sound or breeze, not even a flicker of movement at the far end of the hall. Slowly, Eli stood, embarrassed, trying to calm the rush of heat in his face. The entire affair now felt foolish. Was he really that desperate? He turned and walked back to his room, forcing himself not to glance over his shoulder and avoiding looking at the candle still flickering behind him. He closed the door quietly and climbed back under the blankets. The hallway remained silent. He drifted off sometime after midnight, the absence of the locket bothering him more than he had expected it to. In his dreams, he saw water, shallow and warm, crawling up to the edge of his bed, and heard a voice he hadn't heard in years whispering just outside the door. Eli was awakened later by the sound of soft, polite knocking and sat up, blinking into the darkness. The room was quiet, except for the ticking of the radiator beneath the window and the faint hum of the box fan Miss Julia had set up to combat the heat wave. Then came three slow knocks again, right at the door. He slipped out of bed, his feet sinking into the thin rug. The house was still, and the hall light was off. Miss Julia always left it on until sunrise, but now it was gone, replaced by something colder and dimmer. Eli reached for the knob. Before he could turn it, however, a voice spoke through the wood. "Eli?" it called out. It was her. His knees nearly gave out as he cautiously opened the door. The hallway stretched quietly before him, and he noticed that the candle had gone out. In its place, a woman crouched near the baseboard. She rose slowly, gracefully, as if she weighed nothing at all, and stepped into the moonlight. She looked just like the photo of his mother, with her hair brushed back and curls falling around her collarbones. That same lopsided smile graced her face. "Hi, baby," she said. He stared, unable to speak, barely able to breathe. She came forward, knelt before him, and took his hands in hers. They were cool, but not cold. Her skin felt real, her nails short, clean, and shaped exactly as he remembered. "I missed you," she said, drawing him in. "It's been so long." He buried his face in her shoulder and sobbed. She held him the way she used to when he couldn't sleep after thunderstorms. The familiar, soothing scent of her, of lavender shampoo and freshly laundered cotton, clung faintly to her skin. He sighed in contentment and snuggled closer. "I knew you'd find me," she whispered. "I knew my boy wouldn't forget." When he finally pulled away, she wiped his tears with her sleeve and smiled again. But something was off. She hadn't blinked, not once, and her smile hadn't faded during the embrace. She stood, her movements so fluid it seemed as if she never touched the floor. "I'll stay close," she said. "I'll never leave you again, I promise." Then she stepped back into the shadows of the hallway and vanished. Eli lingered in the doorway for a long time after that. His arms felt numb and his legs tingled as if they'd fallen asleep. When he finally shut the door, it felt heavier than it had before. He climbed back into bed, clutching the blanket around him, and fell into a restless slumber. The following morning, the hallway looked normal again. Eli checked the spot where he'd left the candle and the locket. The candle had melted to a stub, blackened and stuck to the carpet, and the locket was gone. At breakfast, Miss Julia asked if anyone had heard any strange noises overnight. A noise complaint had been reported by the neighbors behind the fence, mentioning something about whispering and a woman singing off-key. No one spoke up, but from the way she eyed him, Eli suspected she knew he had been involved. To his surprise, however, she didn't press the issue, and everyone went on with their day. Trevor sat across the table, his plate untouched. He wasn't drawing today and didn't even pretend to eat, but when Eli met his eyes, something unspoken passed between them. Trevor didn't look angry. He looked afraid. That night, Eli lay in bed and waited. She came again just before 2 a.m. There was no knock this time. He only heard the sound of the door unlatching gently, and then her head poked in.
"Oh, you must have been sleeping," she said. "I didn't mean to wake you."
He nodded slowly as she stepped inside.
"Can I sit with you?" she asked.
He scooted over, and she sat beside him on the edge of the mattress. He noticed that the bed didn't sink under her weight. She reached out, brushing his hair back from his face.
"You're safe now," she said, stroking his cheek with her thumb. "You don't have to be alone anymore."
He wanted to believe it. He needed to. But all the same, something gnawed at him. As before, she never blinked. And he realized, too, that her pupils never shifted. It was as if her eyes were painted on. Tonight, she didn't smell right either. It wasn't an issue with the lavender or cotton. Rather, there was something underneath the more comforting scents, faint but sharp, like the odor of mildew clinging to old wood. When he asked her about the fire, she recalled every detail accurately. She knew the street name, the names of the firefighters, what the neighbors were wearing, and her final words before the window shattered. He hadn't told anyone those things, not even the social workers. She kissed his forehead and tucked him in, humming as she stood. Her hand brushed the corner of the dresser, and just for a second, the lamp flickered. The next morning, the bulb was burnt out. Eli didn't say anything. Miss Julia replaced it, sighing and remarking snidely about the wiring. Trevor didn't come to breakfast. Later that afternoon, Eli went searching for him. He found Trevor in the basement, curled in the corner near the old furnace, surrounded by torn-out pages, each one covered in drawings of empty eye sockets, staring back from every inch of the paper. Eli sat across from him on the concrete floor.
"I think I brought her back," he said.
Trevor looked up slowly, then back down. He picked up a fresh scrap of paper, fumbled for a pen, and scribbled, "That's not your mother." Eli swallowed hard.
"She remembers everything."
Trevor shook his head, and Eli noticed the uncertainty and fear in his eyes.
"She sings the song she used to."
Another paper slid across the floor. "It's wearing her." Eli stared at the words a moment, considering the implications, and stood up. Trevor met his eyes briefly before turning his attention back to his drawings. That night, Eli stayed awake as long as he could, waiting in the dark and watching the door. It opened again at 2:08 a.m. She stepped in without knocking, smiling softly. Her smile remained, and as before, she didn't blink. He didn't sleep that night, and as the sun rose over the horizon hours later, he realized something had changed. She was no longer limited to nighttime visitations. It wasn't long after that when Eli realized the others couldn't see her. One morning, as he walked down the hallway, Miss Julia passed right by him, humming to herself and carrying a basket of towels. She didn't blink or flinch. She simply didn't see the woman standing there, half-shadowed by the upstairs landing, smiling softly as Eli brushed past. It wasn't just Miss Julia. None of the kids reacted either. They didn't respond when she stood by the playroom door or accompanied Eli down the back stairwell. She never touched anyone else or talked to them. She spoke only to him, and at first, only by night. By the end of the week, however, she began to appear at odd times, mid-afternoon and early evening, always when no one was looking. She never announced her presence. She simply materialized nearby, watching and waiting for Eli to notice her. At first, he tried to ignore her and convince himself he was imagining it. But then things started disappearing. His old shoebox of drawings was gone, along with the string bracelet one of the girls had made for him. A birthday card from Miss Julia turned up, torn in half, leaving behind only the words, "To Eli." He found the bracelet in his closet one night, tucked into the folds of a dusty blanket. The string had been stretched out and tied into a loop, as if someone had worn it, or tried to. The next night, she appeared at the edge of his bed once again. "You've been quiet," she said. Eli sat up slowly and replied, "You've been taking my things." "The things you loved are part of me now," she said. Her smile didn't change, even when he stared at her and said, clearly, "You're not my mom." She tilted her head back and asked, "Then why did you call for me?" He didn't answer. She moved closer, her arms opened wide. "You brought me here because you needed me," she whispered. "That hasn't changed." He turned away as her hand hovered just an inch from his shoulder. "I'll be nearby," she said before backing into the dark. He kept the lamp on until sunrise, only dozing off for an hour or so once he was certain she was gone. Trevor skipped breakfast again that day. By that point, he hadn't come down for meals in 2 days. Miss Julia chalked it up to another mood episode and let him be. That morning, she was short-tempered, spilling her coffee and snapping at one of the younger boys for chewing with his mouth open. Eli tried to ask if she'd checked on Trevor, but she waved him off with a tired shrug. "He just needs time," she said. "Some kids go quiet for a bit. That's normal." Eli didn't argue. Later that afternoon, Eli found Trevor's drawings again, spread out in the corner of the rarely used upstairs room. He turned the pages slowly, noting that each one was worse than the last. Once again, the hallway appeared, longer this time, twisted as if bent in the middle. Dark stains crept along the carpet in tendrils, and the candle at the center was drawn in black, the pencil lead rubbed until the page warped. And then there was the woman. She appeared on nearly every page, sometimes standing, sometimes crouched, sometimes in pieces, but always smiling. Her hands were too long, her jaw too wide, and her hair resembled strips of cloth. Her eyes seemed empty, as if whatever lived behind them didn't need to see, only to be seen. Eli heard a creak behind him and quickly folded the papers. When he turned, the hallway was empty, but the light had gone out. That night, she didn't knock. She opened the door before he could even sit up and stepped into the room, sitting beside him as if she belonged there, folding her legs beneath her. "I'm worried about you," she said, her tone warm yet strained. "You're pulling away, and it hurts me when you do that." Eli shifted toward the wall. "You said you'd stay nearby, not in my room." "Did I do something wrong?" she asked. He shook his head. "I just want to sleep." She studied him for a long moment. He didn't look up, but he sensed her watching, unmoving, still as a painting. "You used to hum," he said, "when I was little, before bedtime." She remained silent. Eli finally looked at her. "You used to hum Greensleeves, but you don't do that now." She smiled. "I can hum something if you'd like." "No," he said, "that's not the point." Her expression didn't change, but Eli swore the temperature dipped the moment the words left his mouth. "You're not supposed to ask so many questions," she said softly. "It's better when you just let yourself be loved." Then she left the room, closing the door behind her. Eli stared at the crack beneath the door for a long time, until at last the faint, flickering light beyond the threshold disappeared. That night, he dreamed of Trevor standing in the hallway with a matchbook and a broken mirror, mouthing words that Eli couldn't hear. When he awoke, he noticed fingertip-length scratches on the inside of the door, forming five fresh lines. Eli didn't go to breakfast. He stayed in bed, facing the wall and listening to the house around him. He heard pipes groaning, a chair dragging across the kitchen tile, and Miss Julia's voice rising and falling again, the usual rhythm. Yet beneath that, he sensed something was wrong. He could feel her presence even before the door opened. She no longer bothered waiting for an invitation. The handle turned slowly, followed by the sound of her bare feet on the floor. "Eli," she said gently, "you haven't looked at me today." He remained still. "I know what's wrong. You're scared, but that's just part of healing." He sat up. She stood a few feet away in the center of the room, holding something, his mother's locket. The edges were now smudged and darkened, as if someone had buried it in damp soil. "You said I called you," he whispered. She smiled. "You did." "I said her name. I wanted her back. And here I am." "No," he replied. "You're not her. You're a liar." Something flickered in her face for a moment, a slight twitch under the skin, as if another form were trying to escape. "You brought me into this house. You gave me things she loved and let me in." Her voice was calm, yet something low and rumbling lingered beneath it. "I didn't know what I was doing," he argued. "That doesn't change anything," she replied. She stepped toward him and he backed up, feeling the wall press against him. "I've done so much for you, Eli. I've stayed and watched over you," she continued. "No one else has done that. Not her. Not anyone. I'm all you've got left." He opened the drawer beside the bed, finding the lighter still there, untouched since the ritual. She noticed. "I wouldn't do that," she warned. The hallway door creaked behind her. Trevor stood there, his hands shaking. In one hand, he held a lit candle, and in the other, a jagged shard of mirror, the length of a bookmark. At first, Eli didn't understand. That is, until Trevor tilted the mirror, angling it toward her, and the woman flinched. Her smile remained, but her body recoiled slightly, one shoulder jerking back as if the reflection burned. "Stop," she said, still smiling. Trevor took another step forward. Eli noticed the candle's reflection flickering inside the mirror, catching her face at an unexpected angle. In the glass, her expression cracked. Her lips split at the corners and her eyes widened. Her face became a mask-like shell, devoid of depth. She opened her mouth and the smile broke. There were far too many teeth, layer upon layer of them, causing Eli to recall Trevor's drawings immediately. Eli shuddered as Trevor stepped forward and pushed the mirror closer. The woman screamed, the unnatural shriek scraping against the walls and rattling the old glass in the windows. Eli dropped to the floor, covering his ears. She lurched backward into the hallway, her limbs moving awkwardly and out of sync as though a marionette's strings had become tangled. The wallpaper peeled away as she passed, and the carpet smoldered beneath her feet. She slammed against the far wall and shrank, her shoulders hunching as her body compressed inward, folding into a shape too thin to support itself. Trevor tossed the mirror fragment onto the floor. "Eli," he said, his voice hoarse from disuse. "Call her name again." Eli blinked up at him in confusion. "What?" "The name of your mother, the real one," Trevor insisted. "Just once, while you still can." Understanding washed over Eli, and he nodded, feeling his heart thudding in his chest as he said it again.
Danielle Carver!
The hallway pulsed around them. For a brief moment, he felt her presence. His mother's warmth, a soft touch, the curve of her shoulder as she crouched beside him, whole and undistorted. The woman in the hallway howled as her face crumpled, her eyes collapsing into hollows of writhing darkness. Her limbs split along the joints, her fingers cracked and shattered. And then, just like that, she was gone. The candle extinguished with her, the hallway dimmed, and silence fell again. Trevor knelt beside Eli, breathing hard and staring at the spot where she had stood.
"It never blinks," he muttered, his voice raw. "That's how you know. It watches, but it doesn't see."
Eli wiped his face with his sleeves, his hands trembling. The hallway appeared normal again, more or less, but it felt as if something had been peeled away. He turned to Trevor, questions swirling in his mind.
"The note," Eli accused. "You knew what would happen."
Trevor said nothing, his gaze fixed on the melted candle wax pooled on the carpet.
"You gave me the rules anyway," Eli continued. "Why?"
Trevor looked down, his voice quiet.
"It was the only way to stop it from following me."
Eli's stare deepened, disbelief creeping in.
"It doesn't leave unless someone calls it again," Trevor explained. "If no one ever finishes the ritual, it lingers. It attached itself to me. I thought maybe it would change focus if someone else..."
He swallowed hard, unable to finish the thought. Eli leaned back slightly, his eyes burning with a mix of fear and anger.
"You wanted it to come after me instead." "I'm sorry, Eli."
The words hung between them, honest, yet useless. Eli turned away, unsure whether he wanted to cry or scream. Then Trevor added,
"I stayed close, planning to help. I had to."
At least that part had been true.
"And how did you know about the mirror?" Eli asked. "And about saying my mother's name again?" "This has been going on longer than you know," Trevor said. "Just be glad it's over." "You're sure she's gone?" Eli asked. "Forever?" "I hope so."
The next morning, Miss Julia found both boys asleep in the hallway. At first, she said nothing. She crouched beside them in her robe and bare feet, brushing hair from Eli's face. Her eyes flicked toward the scorch marks on the carpet, the melted wax, and the cracked scrap of mirror. And she sighed.
"Get up," she said gently. "Both of you."
They followed her into the kitchen, where she poured 3 cups of tea and then locked the door, drawing the curtain.
"You're not the first," she said. "And God help me, you probably won't be the last, but you will be the last on my watch."
Her gaze moved from Trevor to Eli, devoid of anger, but filled with the weary finality of someone who'd seen too much and held it in for too long.
"I'll clean the hallway myself, file it under fire damage, and call it an accident. But I need to hear you say it. Promise you'll never speak of this again. Not to the others, not to each other, not to anyone."
Neither boy moved.
"I mean it," she insisted. "This thing survives because people whisper. If you want out, promise me you'll leave this behind you."
Trevor nodded, and Eli did too, both understanding the weight of her words. Miss Julia stood resolute.
"I'll expedite your placement, and I'll make sure you end up in the same house. I know people."
She pointed a finger at them.
"Give me a month and you'll be out of here. But this," she gestured toward the hallway, "this never happened."
She didn't need to say more. Without another word, she left the kitchen and began scrubbing wax from the carpet before the others woke up. Miss Julia never brought up the incident again, but both Eli and Trevor noticed the change in her demeanor, as if a weight had been lifted from her shoulders overnight. From then on, and every day thereafter, she made more time for the kids, laughed more often, and started baking on the weekends for fun for the first time in years. She didn't take things as seriously, and sometimes, when it suited her, she even admitted she was wrong. One afternoon, a few weeks later, a couple came by with a caseworker, a pair of soft-spoken people who didn't flinch at Trevor's silence or rush Eli through the interview questions. They brought puzzles and sketchbooks and asked what the boys liked. They listened closely, laughing easily, and they came back again and again. Miss Julia signed the placement papers herself. As they were preparing for their departure, she handed each boy a sealed envelope containing a short note. Nothing dramatic, just a single line handwritten in clean cursive. "You deserve peace. Make the best of it. I love you both." By spring, Trevor and Eli were packing side by side, preparing, as Miss Julia had promised, to move into a new home together with their adoptive family. Two suitcases, one framed photo, a sketch pad with new drawings, and a promise, shared in the back seat of a slow-moving car as the group home shrank behind them, that they would never dig up the past again. Though they would never forget their birth parents and would always miss them, they made a commitment to move on. Neither boy looked back, and in time, they grew not only to love and care for their new family, but also for one another. Behind them, in a place filled with memories that seemed more dreamlike with the passage of time, the hallway of their former foster home remained forever quiet. Of those remaining in the home, just one person remained who knew the rules of the hallway game. And Miss Julia never said another word. Yes, she'd acknowledged, she'd made a lot of mistakes over the years, but she'd made sure this one ended with her. That was The Hallway Game by Craig Groeschek. Craig Groeschek is the creator and operator of the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel. He oversees production of four weekly audio horror fiction podcasts, faithfully adapting and featuring the works of thousands of indie horror authors. A published author himself, dozens of his stories have been adapted for this channel and other platforms. In his free time, Groeschek enjoys a wide range of outdoor activities, traveling, and spending time with three horror-loving children and his friends. And that, my friends, ends tonight's episode. I'd like to thank you for joining me, and also Ambrose Ibsen and Craig Groeschek for tonight's stories. As always, I'll have a freshly skinned and gutted episode of Horror Hill for you next week, so be sure to come back. Until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.